This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. In this hour, we focus on the soaring cost of higher education, why tuition keeps going up, how colleges and universities are funded, and later in the hour, we'll talk about student debt. The average college senior graduates with a debt load of just under $30,000. If you're just heading off to college, we'll look at the best ways to choose your debt load. And if you're in the middle of trying to figure out how to pay off those loans, we'll talk about that too. But first, how did we get here? Mark Huelsman is senior policy analyst with the public policy organization Demos. Mark, welcome to Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me, Mary.
Let's look first at public colleges and universities. According to Demos, the higher education system has become a debt-for-diploma system. Pick that apart for us, debt-for-diploma.
Well, that's exactly right. As you've mentioned before, student debt has skyrocketed in this country. Over the last 10 years, it's gone from about $250 billion to $1.2 trillion. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of the things that we think you should be focusing the most on is public colleges and universities. About 75% of students go to public institutions, so that's where most students go. And public colleges and universities have primarily, historically, been financed through state dollars. And, you know, whenever there were gaps, they were made up through some tuition for in-state students paying a little bit of money, out-of-state students paying a little bit more money, and then some other sources. But in other words, we used to think of public higher education as a public good. And as recently as 2000, so really not that long ago, the state funded more per student than they brought in through tuition in almost every state, in like 47 out of 50 states. And now tuition revenue exceeds what the state spends in about half of all states. So what we're talking about here is a pretty drastic shift from what we thought of as a public good to a private investment.
So what happened to go from point A to point B?
So a number of things happened, right? I mean, you can point to the recession, in some states that really cut the amount of revenue they could bring in, that really cut the amount of funding they could put towards higher education. And higher education tends to be the biggest part of a state's discretionary budget. So, and it also happens to be a budget item that you can make up through another source, and that's tuition. So a lot of states really just, it was kind of a death by a thousand paper cuts thing. They slowly cut and then started making tuition inch up as a percentage of what the total higher education budget was.
So when economic times are tough, states backed off funding for higher education. And, of course, we're out of the Great Recession of the late 2000s. Why not refund then when the economy's healthier?
So that's a good question. And another thing is that we've seen more students go to college, right? You see more students go during tough economic times. There's fewer jobs. People may need to go back to retool some skills or just go, if they haven't attended higher education before. And last year was really the first year we saw budgets tick up again, but they really only ticked up about 1.5%. And at that rate, it would take almost a decade for us to get to where we were before on state funding. So it's not really enough.
So do states actively look then to refund, or is it kind of low on the radar?
I think you're seeing some states really take a hard look and understand that, hey, we've gone farther away than we ever thought we would have in terms of higher education funding. The problem still is that there's not a lot of money to play with in state budgets. They've rebounded a little bit, but there really is a long way to go in sort of getting back to where we were before the recession. But you're seeing some states spend a little bit more money. But even last year when states overall spent a bit more money, and again, it was about 1.5%, 20 states still cut higher education budgets last year. So there's, it's still a very large problem.
This really affects low and moderate income households, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. We talk about the squeeze of the middle class and middle class families having to spend a lot of family income to send their kid to college, but low income families have really been soaked by these policies. Low income families have to fork over about 75% to 100% of family income if they want to send their kids to college. And it's no surprise then, if they're expected to spend that much in family income, that 9 in 10 students who receive Pell Grants, so 9 in 10 low-income students, have to borrow if they want to graduate. So it's really kind of mandatory for low-income students to borrow. And one of the effects of this is that many populations tend to be debt-averse, right? Low-income populations oftentimes don't want to take on debt. They're cash strapped already. They see the sticker price of education. They don't want to take on debt, and so they either won't go, and so you have lower enrollment rates, or they'll attend part-time, work a lot more so they don't have to borrow, and all of those things make them less likely to end up finishing a degree at the end.
So, Mark, then, how does this shape the middle class 10 years down the road? What do you think it would look like?
Well, I think this, you know, the national conversation we're having around social mobility and income inequality, you can finger our higher education system as sort of one of the big pieces of that, right? You know, if you're a low-income family and you're not likely to want to borrow to go to college, or you're not likely to end up finishing a degree program, you're much less likely to go into the middle class, right? And this is happening against a backdrop of a society that's saying we need to go, you know, more people need to go to college, more people need to complete degrees, and all of that's true, because if you complete a bachelor's degree or even an associate's degree, you're much less likely to be unemployed. You're much more likely to earn more money than those who just graduate high school. But we're sort of erecting all of these barriers and sending mixed signals to students by saying you really need some form of post-secondary education to participate in today's workforce, but you know, we're going to make you take on debt to do so. We're going to make it less likely that you're going to be able to afford it.
And debt can also shape your trip into the middle classes, as you're alluding to. Let's look at that for a moment. You mentioned that student debt is huge in this country. It's over $1.2 trillion. How does that affect the economy?
Well, we think, you know, it's pretty intuitive, but it should be a drag on the economy. There are fewer first-time home buyers out there. You know, young people are a little bit less likely to buy a car or save for retirement than they used to be. And our research at Demos has shown that for a married college-educated household, so that's the sort of, you know, ideal American dream household, the average student loan debt today can really lead to over a loss of over $200,000 in wealth over a lifetime relative to that married college-educated household that didn't have to take on debt to go to college. And that just means that people are delaying decisions, right? They're delaying decisions to buy a home. They're delaying decisions to save for retirement, and really not being able to participate in sort of wealth-building activities that other generations used to be able to do.
We're actually going to address how to handle student debt a little bit later in the show, but let's get back to funding colleges and universities, in particular public institutions. Mark, when a public university loses state funding, tuition is not the only thing affected, right? In other words, you might see fewer courses, you might see staff laid off. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. You're seeing in a lot of the institutions that this affects, right? When we think about public institutions, we tend to think about the state flagships, so your Penn States, your Rutgers, et cetera. But there are many, many public institutions out there that aren't your state flagships, right? About 40% of students go to community colleges, which are directly affected, if not, you know, outlandishly so, by state budget cuts. Community colleges in the past 10 years really haven't spent much more money in their budgets. They're just getting a lot less from the state, right? And they are the ones who have to keep tuition low in order to remain affordable. That's sort of their mission, is to keep an affordable higher education option available for students. So you see fewer classes being taught. You see fewer programs being offered. You see fewer full-time professors, the move to adjunct professors and things like that. And that really affects students. And to give you an example, if you're a student who's attending a community college and maybe wants to transfer to a four-year school, and that community college isn't getting the funding to offer you some of the programs that you might need to go to that four-year school, you're not going to have the option to take that class the next semester, and you're going to have to wait another semester to see if that class is offered. And so you see a lot of swirling in that system, and we're actually, you know, erecting a ceiling on students being able to transfer to a four-year school or get an associate's degree if that's what they decide to do.
Mark Huelsman is Senior Policy Analyst with the Public Policy Organization Demos. We're taking your calls here at Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mark, according to Demos, affordability, of course, is very closely linked to state funding levels, but among the five least affordable states is Pennsylvania?
That's correct. And Pennsylvania has cut higher ed funding per student about 30% since the recession. And Pennsylvania is, you're right, one of the most unaffordable states in the country. I believe it's the third highest tuition and fees at public four-year schools. So really, we're saying, you know, and again, this is intuitive, you can really draw a direct line between how much the state is providing per student and what students end up having to pay.
And affordability is linked to student debt. That's
yes,
a no-brainer
exactly.
Right there.
That's exactly right. You know, it gets made up, you know, through students having to borrow. And another thing I wanted to mention is that when we think of college costs, you know, and the rising cost of higher education, most folks really focus on tuition and fees or the rise in tuition and fees. And in some cases, that's appropriate, right? You know, that's the sort of thing that the state can or the school can, you know, really control. But that really only accounts for 40%, maybe half, of what students have to pay to go to college. You have room and board or living expenses if you're living at home. You have books. You have supplies. You have transportation costs. And that's actually the bulk of higher education costs. And, you know, if students go full-time, there's the opportunity cost of not working. So concentrating on tuition and fees is important, and a lot of times that's what the state can control. But when we talk about the cost of college or the total cost of what it's going to take you to attend higher education, the other costs, the living costs, tend to factor in even more than tuition.
One focus here is on affording college in this particular hour of Radio Times, and we'll get into grants and loans a little bit later in the show. But let's for a second look at the federal Pell Grant. It doesn't go nearly as far as it used to in helping a student defray costs, no?
That's exactly right. When the Pell Grant program was designed, it was really designed as a promise to low-income students. And again, we wanted, as a society, to have a greater number of disadvantaged students really climb up that economic ladder. And the federal government said, okay, we're going to provide you a grant if you're low-income to cover the majority of college costs. And when the Pell Grant program was designed, it covered 3/4 of college costs at public four-year institutions, right? And so what that meant was that the other quarter could be really reasonably managed by students who are working. There's the old story about you could work for a summer at a minimum wage and really attend the cost of college, and that was true. I mean, it's not just a folk story. That was true. And now the Pell Grant, because one of the rising cost of college and two, because, you know, the maximum Pell Grant over time didn't really grow that much, it really only covers 1/3 of college costs at public four-year institutions. And again, it's no surprise that students who have to take on Pell Grants, and this is, we're talking about low-income students here, mm-hmm. those are the ones who have to borrow. And 90% of them, if they want to graduate, have to borrow.
All right, the odds are stacked against them, it seems. We're up against a break here. Mark Huelsman, we'll be back in just a moment here on Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about the high cost of higher education. How are colleges funded, and why is tuition going up? Mark Huelsman, senior policy analyst at Demos, will be right back. His research focuses primarily on college affordability, student debt, financial aid, and state investment in higher education. If you'd like to join the conversation, again, the number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Back in a moment.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows 6 enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
And we are scatterings of Africa.
I'm Robin Young. Johnny Clegg, who formed one of the first racially mixed bands in South Africa, sees a bright future for the continent.
Africa is managing to reconfigure and reshape itself coming out of colonialism. You know, Africa is the comeback kid.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Music, epic in its scope, in its spirit. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Bruckner's final unfinished Ninth Symphony, and Lisa Batyashvili plays the first violin concerto of the young, heartbroken Béla Bartók. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Lisa Batyashvili, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoane on Radio Times. We're talking about why it costs so much to go to college, how higher education is funded, and also we'll be focusing on student debt in just a few minutes on Radio Times. Our guest for the first half hour is Mark Huelsman, Senior Policy Analyst for the Public Policy Institution Demos. And Mark, we have a call from Alexandra. Alexandra, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be on.
Thank you for calling. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to say that your conversation is really pertinent to me. I left high school when I was 17 and started working right away in order to try to save up just for community college classes in order to transfer. In many cases, I've been working jobs, like part-time jobs, like 7 days a week, almost 70 hours a week sometimes. And I just wanted to say that it's been hard just trying to save up. And I've seen my friends, and I'm nearly 27 now. I've seen my friends, and they're all my age, maybe younger, maybe older. They're either graduated from school or back in grad school. Mm. They're accumulating money that's like, in some cases, their debts are up to, if not over, $100,000.
Scary.
And it's terrifying to me because at some point, you know, I'm trying to put away for like an IRA. I've been trying to put away for a car. I don't even know if I can put away to save for a house.
And Mark Huelsman, I'm sorry, Alexandra.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say also, like, since I haven't gone to school right away, I have been able to travel, have been able to meet people in more flexible situations. And I have a lot of friends in Britain, and they're around my age. They're around from the same socioeconomic backgrounds. They're all married. They're all having children. They're all buying houses. They all have cars.
Alexandra, thank you so much. We're up against the clock a little bit, but I take your point, and I'm guessing, Mark Huelsman, that you hear this story an awful lot.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that, you know, you see people delaying enrollment, you know, like Alexandra was. It's folks who, you know, might want to save up a little bit to go to community colleges or, you know, tend to go to community college. And again, those classes might not be offered that makes them able to seamlessly transfer to a four-year school. One point that I wanted to make based on the comment that, you know, you see people with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And I think those numbers tend to get a lot of the headlines out there. There's the example of the student with $100,000 in debt who's now working as a coffee shop employee or whatever, and mm-hmm. those do exist out there. But one of the real crises with student debt that doesn't get mentioned is students who borrow but drop out. About a third of students who do borrow end up dropping out of school and not getting a credential. And what this means is that the balance on loans that end up defaulting, so the students who really have the most trouble paying off their loans and end up defaulting, is about half of what the average bachelor's degree recipient carries in debt. So, you know, that, you know, you would think that high volumes of debt would mean that you're more likely to default on loans, and that's not always true, actually. It's the student who borrowed to go to community college or borrowed to go to a four-year school, didn't receive a credential, so didn't really get that, you know, benefit in the labor force, but still has some debt to go along with it. And those are the ones that end up defaulting on loans. So I tend to want to just have, I think we should have a national conversation around those who borrow but drop out.
I just wanted to say, Alexandra, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Mark Huelsman, let's take that point a little bit further. What is the fallout from default and from a lot of default?
Well, one thing that student debt is actually a original form of debt in that you really can't discharge it in bankruptcy. You know, it's really hard to get rid of. Even in some cases, even if you die, you can't get rid of it, sort of thing. It's passed on to your family. But so it's a particularly onerous form of debt. And, you know, students who default can have their wages garnished. They can have their Social Security eventually garnished. And that really, again, you want to talk about a drag on the economy and a drag on people being able to be financially solvent. That's a huge part of it.
Is this something that is discussed with prospective students before they attend college? If you take on this loan, then really you need to try to complete your path, or else you're really going to be facing it if you can't get a job. You don't have that degree.
Absolutely, and I think that we could probably do a better job of telling students the, I want to say, odds they're up against, sort of thing. You know, most students who go to college, you know, I did it. You go to college and you don't think you're going to drop out, right? No one goes to college with the assumption that I'm going to fail at this. And students who go to school are peppered with a ton of information when they're enrolling and going through the gates, and they'll pretty much sign anything, right? They'll say, oh, well, absolutely, I'll afford this, and this is going to be a good investment. And that's true for the most part. It usually is a good investment, particularly if you finish. But, you know, students don't really have the understanding that, you know, there might be a higher threshold for, you know, or the higher difficulty for getting through college than they might assume when they get in.
Mark, let's look for just a second at for-profit schools. I mean, needless to say, the debt load is that much higher, or it quite often is.
Absolutely, and I think that there's been some more light shone on the practices of some for-profit institutions in the past few years. There was a really big Senate report a couple years ago on it. For-profit schools enroll about 13% of all students, but they account for almost half of all student loan defaults. And 9 in 10 students who end up graduating from a for-profit school borrow to do so. The costs tend to be much higher. The graduation rates tend to be much lower, in some cases as low as 10%. And a lot of for-profit schools, a lot of their revenue comes from federal money at the end of the day. It's students coming with their Pell Grants. It's coming with their subsidized or unsubsidized loan dollars. So that's really offering the base of operations for for-profit institutions. And in a lot of cases, they're not doing a particularly good job of getting students through and getting students into the labor force so they're able to pay off their loans.
And Mark, we've got a couple minutes here before we switch focus, but does a marquee name on your diploma, say a Harvard or a Princeton, necessarily guarantee you a job any more so than an in-state public institution?
Well, that's been an interesting question among academics for some time, the sort of value of the elite institution. And there is some, you know, different opinions on it, right? One of the things that that confuses the subject, so to speak, is that students who end up going to elite institutions, Harvard, Yale, et cetera, they may have come from families where they were going to succeed anyway at the end of the day. So there have been a couple of studies that show that if you went to the same type of students who applied to Harvard, Yale, Ivy League, Stanford, et cetera, who ended up going to state institutions, they do pretty much just as well as students. You know, if you went to Penn State over Harvard, you know, there is a lot of value of your Ivy Leagues in the labor market, so to speak, but there's more of a question over whether or not that's directly from the school or whether that was just because you were a great student in the first place and you were more motivated.
All right. We've got a question from Mark. Mark, you're on the air with Mark Huelsman. Hello.
Hi there. I'm a faculty member at Westchester University.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a big flap where a number of administrators and such decided they wanted to leave the state system because we're being underfunded to the point now where 24% of our budget comes from the state, and we're the actual state-owned system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how the response to that has basically been, well, we're going to have to raise some tuition, and it really goes the privatization route, and you wonder at a certain point, why are we not being funded at an actual public level? And if we go private, then you basically have unaffordable public education, and it seems like the legislature has not been has been errant in its task of keeping an affordable education system in the state.
Mark, thanks so much for the telephone call. Mark Huelsman, what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, that's something that's systemic across the country, and again, you know, Pennsylvania is a perfect example of this, where we, as a country, used to fund public higher education as a public good, and now we're funding it more and more through private investment, either from, you know, students themselves through their own money or through loan dollars, or finding some other revenue stream that can keep the institution going. And one other thing I wanted to say is that this is kind of the opposite of what we used to do with K-12 system. You know, as a country, we said, look, we need students to have free and compulsory education up to a certain point. And every state now has free and compulsory education through 16, 17, 18 years old. And we're saying that as a higher ed system now, that, hey, you need to get some form of training. You need to get some sort of post-secondary education. But instead of doing what we did with K-12, which was make it free and easy and compulsory in some cases to go, we've actually made it harder to go and harder to raise money and harder for institutions to really have that sort of, you know, base of funds that they could offer that education.
Mark, thanks for the telephone call to Radio Times. And Mark Huelsman of Demos, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Mark is Senior Policy Analyst for Demos, and as promised, we now turn our attention fully to student debt. As we mentioned earlier in the show, the average senior graduates close to $30,000 in debt, which, depending on your employment, can affect whether you buy a home, a car, or maybe even get married. It's almost too easy to rack up debt as you work your way through school, and here with some important insight into the process is Raina Goebel, author of the Cliff Notes book, Graduation Debt, How Smart Students Pay for School. And she's also an education contributor to Forbes. Raina Goebel, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, happy to be here, Mary.
So as we stated earlier in the show, the average student graduates close to $29,500 in debt. Before we start talking about handling debt, let's look at choosing it. As a parent who's going through it, we're right in the middle of it, even though it's round two for us, the amount of choice out there, Raina, is absolutely dizzying. So first, let's parse the types of loans that are available, private versus government.
Yeah, I think before, private loans got a really bad rap, largely because they do have some distinct disadvantages to public loans. For instance, you don't have the repayment options as much if you get into trouble, but there are fixed rate private loans now. They used to all be where they were variable rates. So, but the problem is because you don't have those same options for when you do get into financial trouble, where you can take a payment break, where you can get income-based repayment, really they're not as good an option no matter what the interest rate is. The only time that they are a good option is if you're returning to school, you're borrowing, say, $10,000 that you know you can repay in 2 years. So you still want to stick with federal student loans.
What is the rule of thumb for taking on debt? I've heard it shouldn't be more than what you'd make as an employee 1 year out of school than the total debt that you take on for all 4 years of college. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that one problem we get into is giving a general rule. It's so individualized. It depends on what you want to do. It depends on the income that you expect, but it also depends on how much you want that job. For instance, public service loan forgiveness, where you can get partial forgiveness after 10 years combined with income-based repayment, you may do okay taking on a little more debt, like, say, $60,000, because you know that you'll get some forgiven if those programs continue. I think that the biggest thing I stress to parents is really that when you're borrowing, that you're thinking about the income after school and that you're always conscious of the debt. So every semester, it's being recalculated what that payment is going to be, and also that the student is thinking about what their after-graduation budget is going to be, which they can do with student money management offices on campus or go through their budget with someone from the credit union on campus. So really that it's a conscious thing. And also when they're choosing a school, they're comparing financial aid and who's giving them not just the amount of scholarships, but what that final price is going to be to attend that school. And then they can look at it and compare and really just make sure it's a consumer decision and that whatever they do, that they're conscious of why they're picking that school, how much debt they're going to have, and what the payment's going to be.
Now, the concept of the student loan is a little dangerous, isn't it? I mean, it's not like a car loan where you know you're going to get that statement every single month and you're going to have to pay that amount every single month. I mean, it racks up, and at the end of 4 years, that's when you have to deal with it. You kind of forget about it. Can't you?
Yeah, I mean, I forgot about mine, which is partly why I wrote the book, is to kind of help others. I mean, you can go to the Student Loan Data System website, which there's a link to on my website, graduationdebt.org, and I'm going to post something with some of the resources I mentioned to parents in a blog about an hour after the show. And you can lose track of loans. I lost track of one and ended up with a default that I have since recovered from, and it's no longer on my credit report.
Well, how did you go through that process when you defaulted, and how did you recover?
Yeah, and it's actually going to be a better process coming up, too. For me, I called up and we found out what my payment could be on that defaulted loan based on my income at the time. I had a reasonable payment. 9 months later, I was able to reconsolidate it or consolidate it with my other loans. And it was really an easy process, and it scares people. The word default in itself scares people, but there is a rule that after 9 months of payments, you can get it removed from your credit report that you've ever defaulted. And that's one reason why it's so important to me that I share this information, because I want to help others avoid my mistakes. But also, if they did make it, I want them to know it's like there are so many ways to recover with student loans. And there are so many payment plans based on income, based on different things. You don't have to make this a life-altering thing. You can use your education to the best of your ability and focus on your career while making a payment that you can't afford.
Okay. Raina Goble is our guest. She is the author of the Cliff Notes book, Graduation Debt, and we've got a call from Ken. Welcome, Ken, to Radio Times.
Hi. This is a fantastic program, and I want to preface it
by
saying this is the year that I fell out of love with my undergraduate school.
Aww.
Precisely because of this issue. And I'd like to ask, I mean, if, given the political future and the economic future that we can foresee, middle-class students are going to have to pay for their own education in their working lifetime. And so what's a reasonable amount of debt for a student to carry away from undergraduate school and professional education into their working lifetime?
Easy to get your arms around that?
Income, 20%, what?
Thanks, Ken. Raina, what do you think?
Well, Ken, I don't think that there's an exact number. Like I said, it's based on what you want to do with your life. You know, you might qualify for public service loan forgiveness, but just that you're conscious of what the payment is going to be. Someone who's going to live in New York may not be able to afford as much of a payment as someone that's going to live in Nebraska, making pretty much the same salary after graduation. So I think it's that every semester a student goes to career services and finds out what their income could prospectively be, as well as talking to somebody with budgeting. But the one caveat that I have to that is you don't want to spend $150,000 or over $100,000, and then you're kind of keeping yourself in a little corner as far as what you can do after graduation, because I've seen someone go to school to become a corporate lawyer and then end up a public defender, and then they have $150,000 in debt. So you just want to be conscious of that. Don't rack up $100,000 and really make sure every semester you're thinking about that, including the scholarship money that may be offered to you that semester, because scholarships don't end freshman year. So everything should be a conscious effort when it comes to money. And I hope that answers your question, and I really appreciate your call.
Yes, we do. We appreciate your call to Radio Times, Ken. Raina, I love this this quote from an attorney. Well, love is a strong word, but I read this in an AP article. He's 48 years old. He's chipping away at nearly $160,000 in debt since graduating back in 2005 from law school. He's having trouble getting a mortgage. He's engaged, but doesn't feel he can get married. His fiance has a 10-year-old child. And he says, I have more education and more degrees than my father, as does she than her parents, and yet our parents are better off than we are. What's wrong with this picture? Now, we're up against a break here, so we're going to address that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Thank you very much for joining us. If you'd like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Gratz College supports WHYY. Gratz College presents Randy Cohen, the creator of David Letterman Top 10 Lists and former ethicist for the New York Times Magazine, Thursday, May 1st at 7:30 p.m. at Har Zion Temple on the Main Line. The Gratz College Annual Gala with Randy Cohen celebrates 118 years of education grounded in Jewish values, Thursday, May 1st at 7:30 p.m. For information, gratz.edu, gratz.edu.
Alan Cumming is reprising his role as the MC in the new Roundabout Theater Company revival of Cabaret. It's his third time in the role. He won a Tony in the 1998 production. On the next Fresh Air, he'll tell us what it's like playing the MC as he approaches his 50th birthday. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
According to a new study from the SPLC, most states barely teach civil rights in school. Pennsylvania and New Jersey got grades of D. This is a movement that dramatically changed human rights in America only a few generations ago. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear from the SPLC about what teens are learning about civil rights in America. Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and for Marty Moskowain, we're talking about student debt and college, and our guest this half hour is Raina Goebel, author of the Cliff Notes book, Graduation Debt. And Raina, just before we went to break, we were talking about an attorney who's about 48 years old, and he has so much debt that he feels that even though he has more education than his parents did, they're doing better than he's doing. Typical? Or is that the danger there in taking on a whole lot of debt?
It's a danger in taking on a lot of debt, but it's also the reason why my book focuses on the first thing is to forgive yourself for the debt that you borrowed. Maybe you chose a school that was more expensive, but now you've got to deal with it. And I had a case study in my book with two lawyers that combined, they married each other, and they had $300,000 in student loan debt, and one was a public defender. And we talked about different ways that they could cut their budget, and they were still able to get approved for mortgage and bought their first home. So it depends how much home that this person is looking to buy. And to just think about all areas of their budget, for instance, are you having a lot of grocery spoil? I talked to a couple that they are wasting $550 a month because one person didn't talk to the other about buying prepared foods, and so they'd buy double groceries. And so there's all these little ways to save money, but the first thing is forgiving yourself for the amount that you borrowed, not worrying about, did I borrow too much? Do I have all this debt? What is my plan for paying it off? And that's always been my big focus because that's how you help people. I had, when I was married, that was one thing before I got married that we talked about was my student loans. And you can't feel guilty for it. Just be happy you have your education and that you have that opportunity to be a lawyer and do what you want. Now it's just time to budget and figure out the situation that you have and that you've been dealt.
Well, Raina Goebel, this is a big subject for a lot of people. We've got a lot of phones and some tweets. Let's go to Chris. Chris, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, how are you? I think that students and families can really save a lot on the amount that they're paying for college if they focus their interest on college planning. A lot of financial problems with college can be avoided if they're focused on the end goal, which is career advancement. So they may understand that the training that they need in the end can be attained without taking on all of that college debt from the beginning. So they may want to put their attention on the career, on selecting the school, and then making sure that that school has exactly what they need so they can be beneficial in the end.
And Chris, thanks for the call. Raina, what do you think?
I love Chris. Chris is so spot on. The thing is that you have to be in touch with career services before you go to any college. And second is you should be doing shadow days in school. You don't want to graduate with that degree and not be employed or not be employed in a career that you love. So it's really important students do have that career focus. I called before I selected my school when I returned to school, and I asked, what internships do you have? Where are your graduates working? I ask these questions ahead of time so that you're not dumbfounded when you graduate and don't know where you're going to be working. And then that's how you can compare, is the school going to be worth it to take on this debt? And then you can talk about financial aid and compare schools that way. But I think it's two-pronged. It's always comparing cost and comparing career opportunity. And one thing I really want to say about that is everyone thinks good school. Good school depends on the person. And I was able to go to the same networking functions with my MBA as someone who graduated from Harvard. I have a state college degree, and Susie Orman has a state college degree. So you really want to think about that and just compare based on what the opportunities will be as well as what the real experience will be for the student.
And we did touch on that point a little bit earlier with Mark Huelsman. Judy is standing by, and Judy has an interesting question about the Stafford loans. Judy, hello?
Yeah. Hello, Judy.
Okay.
Hi. I wanted to ask, why are the rates on the Stafford loans so high? Right now they're at 6.8%, and I have two daughters with loans out, and one's about to be paid off. And that's a private loan, and her rates are like 2.75, 3.0, and they were taken out at a time when interest rates are low. Interest rates are low now, so why are the Stafford rates so high?
That's a sore point for so many people. Raina?
Yes. It's definitely a sore point for a lot of people. It's hard to say. You know, they may factor in how many people default on student loans, different programs, but I do know that those rates have been lowered recently. It's just that whatever rate that you get it at the time is a fixed rate. My advice to your daughter, of course, would be to look into income-based repayment and some of the other options available to her. But, yeah, I mean, 6.8 was a bit high during that market. There's no real argument for why it should have been that high.
Judy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So, Raina, how can student debt affect your credit rating?
It generally doesn't as much as other debt. I think where it affects it is if you're missing payments. That's why it's very hard when you see something where it says, I can't get a mortgage because of the student loan debt. Well, are you paying it off every month? Did you default? What is going on with it? Because if you're paying it every month, you're more than likely building credit. So I think that the main thing is that when it comes to building credit is that you have at least one credit card, you're spending less than 10 or 15% on it per month and paying that off. You're never maxing it out to get points. Because it could be any time during that month that the credit bureaus look at it and say, oops, he's used the maximum amount, mm-hmm. even though he paid it off that same month. So I think the lesson is to just make sure that you're paying your loans every month, and it should affect your credit in a positive way. And then, of course, the bigger issue is how much debt you're borrowing to make sure that you're really thinking about it as you go. And that you forgive yourself and just come up with a game plan after you already have it.
We're talking about college debt, student loans, how to manage them. Raina Goebel is our guest, and we've got a tweet from Melissa. Melissa asks, what about middle-class families who don't get federal aid like Pell Grants but make too much for aid directly from schools? What do you think, Raina?
Oh, I love this question, and thank you, Melissa, for tweeting. I love the word tweet. There are two things. Number one, is that I really worry for middle-class families that don't fill out the FAFSA, because what if financial need is at one school is different than another. For instance, at Harvard, a family can make $200,000 and still get some need-based aid. So always fill out the FAFSA. There is so much more aid out there than you really think there is. And then there's always merit-based scholarships, too. So my biggest advice is to avoid that mindset, because there may be a lot more financial aid than you think there is.
And the FAFSA, which stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid. Raina, it is a pain in the keister to fill out. As somebody who has done that once and is about to do it again, what are some tips to trying to make that whole process go faster? There's such a lot of information you have to have on hand to fill it out, although at the end of the day, it's worth it. If you can get some money, it's worth it, right?
Right. And the first question is to clear your mindset. You never know what financial aid you're going to receive. And this is your first introduction to the school that, hey, I want money from you. Whether it's merit, whether it's financial, I want money. So here I am. Have your latest tax return available. And make sure that you have any financial statements from investments with you. Just have all your financial information in a folder, somewhere in your computer, somewhere where you have access to it. And then, just like I said, clear your mind and be ready to follow up with schools. A phone call to a financial aid office or the department office can make thousands of dollars in difference in what scholarships you receive.
Is it possible for a middle or low-income family to get through college debt-free, Raina Goebel?
Well, I think it's always possible, but it's not necessarily the goal. I had friends that took 10 years to graduate because they went to school part-time. How much money were they losing by taking lower-paying jobs in order to be debt-free? I think the key is that it's planned and you're thinking about, I'm going to have X payment per month, and I'm okay with that because I want to do this job, and I took on a reasonable amount of debt. Not no debt, but a reasonable amount of debt. As long as you plan, you'll be fine. And like I said, the goal should not be to be debt-free, but to have a career and a life that you're happy with.
So I guess the $64,000 question then is, it better to take on a bunch of debt if that's what you have to do to get that degree as opposed to saying, I'm just going to avoid this and not go to college?
Yes. For as long as you have a plan that you know what the career you want is and that you're not borrowing $100,000 to have a job that's going to make $40,000. So I think as long as you think about it and that you're talking with the right people, you're talking with financial aid, you're talking with any budgeting office that's on campus, and that you're just really thinking about it and that you're always career-focused, always doing internships, always doing shadow days, always focused on the end result, which is having a career that you love, that you're really, really happy with.
Raina Goble is our guest. She's the author of Graduation Debt. And the telephone number to call if you'd like to join the conversation, we've got a little bit of time left this hour of Radio Times, is 1-888-477-9499. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Raina, it's best if you start at the very beginning, if you are the parent to young children, to get started saving. What are some good long-term investment strategies for parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think that first of all, you should look into your state's 529 plans. And some states even have, and the 529 plans are college investment accounts. The growth is tax-free federally. And often some of the contributions are deductible on your state tax returns as well. So these, it's a great option, and it's designed for that. But also, some states will do matching contributions for what you put in up to a certain amount, so you could get a few hundred dollars a year free. I mean, you really just want to look at all those options early. And, of course, if you start early, that money adds up. Another good option are prepaid plans, such as the private college savings plan for schools like Harvard, where you buy tuition at today's prices for tomorrow, as well as prepaid plans that are available in about 10 states where it's the same thing, where you buy at today's tuition for a state school per se. Pennsylvania has an Ivy League option where if you live in Pennsylvania, you're associated with Pennsylvania, you can buy tuition at one of 8 Ivy League schools. So it's really amazing what's out there. And the earlier you look at it, even if you can only put in $25 a month or $10 a month, it adds up, and it adds up quick.
So the key is a month. You want to set something aside every month, if possible.
Yeah, or, you know, with tax returns or bonuses, there's also programs where you can get free money or money from family. GradSave allows you to post something for birthday parties and collect money on that website, or different events that you want to do, graduation from even kindergarten. Kindergarten graduation can be a college savings event. And you promise where you collect money from your online shopping. So there are plenty of ways. Some ways are even free. You don't even have to have a dollar available. And if you do GradSave or if you do, you promise, you're saving for your kids' education.
All right. We've got David on the line. David, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I was just calling to comment on Raina's statement about students, when they're going into college and planning how much debt they're going to incur, are having to make decisions about what career they want to do, or at least have an idea of what job they want at the end. It seems to me that the majority of people going into college have no idea what they're going to be doing when they're leaving. You know, that's the whole point behind the whole Bachelor of Arts degree, is coming out with just so many opportunities. So you really can't plan that.
That's a good point, David.
So you don't know what
you're
going to be when you're finished.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. So many people, Raina Goble, switch majors. And college is ostensibly supposed to be a time for exploration, at least a part of it, right?
Right. And I completely understand David's point. And there's two things I'd like to say to it. That's why you should be doing internships the whole time. And if you really graduate having no idea what you want, then that's not a good thing. You really should be doing internships the whole time. You may change careers in your lifetime. You may have different options, but if you don't have a couple of internships during school to explore different careers, you're not going to do as well out of school. There are statistics that you are up to 60% more likely to be employed if you have internships. but that doesn't mean that you can't change majors. And I do think that if you really don't have a clear idea of what you want to do after graduation, then you probably do need to borrow less debt, because you may make $40,000 when you get out, you may make $25,000 when you get out, you may make $60,000 or $70,000. You just don't know yet. And so, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be exploring. That's why I love Shadow Days. You spend a couple of hours with a professional asking questions, and you can start to hone in on what you really want to do. You don't have to know what you want to do day one, but you should have an idea when you graduate.
All right. Thanks, David, for the call. We have time for one more very quick question. Andre, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my question. I got a couple of calls from different companies offering to consolidate my loans and offer some crazy low percentage and saying that after 10 years of payments, my loan will be forgiven. Are you familiar with this? Can you offer us any help?
What do you think about that, Raina?
Well, I think if they're federal student loans, Andre, you should always start off with just calling the federal government, and that's free. If they're going to say, well, I'm going to give you a better rate, like I said, well, if you get into financial trouble, et cetera, you need those programs that the federal government offers you. So talk to your lenders first. See what they'll offer you. See what those programs are. And then I recommend that anybody just randomly calls you. I would never give out financial information on the phone from someone calling me. I would find out through their website, and then I would call the state and make sure they're legitimate first before even considering anything. But as a general rule, if you have a federal loan, talk to the federal government. And any loan, talk to your servicer first about what options might be available to you.
Andre,
great question.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times. So Raina, as we wrap up the show, just some quick bullet points for parents to remember and students in about 30 seconds.
Sure.
If you're looking to start the process, what do you need to keep in mind?
Fill out the FAFSA no matter what. Remember that low income, middle income, you may qualify for a lot more loans than you think, or a lot more actual scholarships and aid. Make sure that you are applying for scholarships. And above all, whatever you do, make sure there's a career focus involved. Do internships. Always encourage your children to do Shadow Days as well.
Raina Goble, I've got to stop you there, but thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. Raina Goble, author of the book Graduation Debt. You can head to whyy.org, Radio Times, to find out more about the program. The engineer for today's show is Adam Stanishevsky. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, with assistance today from Sophie Reed. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, filling in for Marty Moskowitz. Thanks for joining us.